Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to Turned Out of Punk. My name is Damien, and today on the show, my new pal Chris Candy is here. Chris plays in Bull Shannon, a fun band with three bass players, an awesome new band, but also he has helped produce two of my favorite documentaries that came out this last year. First, the Bill Bartell documentary, which if you need to find out more information, you can check out the episode with Jordan Schwartz and Dave Markey. Thank you to Jordan Schwartz for actually connecting us for this episode. It's an amazing movie. We'll talk about it. We talk about it a lot on this episode. But also, he has produced a new, or helped produce a new documentary about his late father, John Candy, I Like Me. Man, this documentary is a beautiful tribute to one of my favorite comedians, actors of all time. I cried. I cried like a baby watching this thing, and I'm sure some of you will too. It will be premiering on Amazon October the 10th. And it's also going to be doing a run of theatrical shows coming up. So hopefully it's playing in a town near you. Go and see this movie if you get the chance, or stream it, or go to someone's house who has it and just watch it there. Just see this movie. It is a great, great film. Open the Toronto Film Festival. And Chris, while he was in town, was kind enough to come over to the chaos that is the Turned Out of Punk studio and put up with my weird shoddy video setup. He definitely wound up holding the camera for part of it. And we had a great conversation. And Chris is someone who loves punk rock, was deeply, deeply affected by this music, as you'll hear on this episode, and is kind of a bridge between two of my favorite worlds in SCTV and comedy and punk. And, or three, I guess that's three. Well, comedy and SCTV are kind of one world. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out Bull Shannon. There's a link to them in the description for this episode. They're on Instagram and all those sorts of fun places. And also check out the Bill Bartell documentary and the John Candy documentary. Both are, they're contenders for the Turned Out of Punk Oscar this year, I'll tell you that much. This show is, of course, produced and booked, guest booked by Tristan Abraham, my brother. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. You can reach us at turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com or at turnedoutofpunk on various social media platforms. And that's it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Chris Candy on Turned Out a Punk. All right, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Damien.
You have, as I said 2 seconds ago before I hit record, you have gone through the ringer so far, learning with me as I've tried to discover the room's technical capabilities. It's rare that people come over. It's rare that people are willing to come over. So, you know, the last people that were here, though, you're in good company, was me first in the Gimme Gimme.
Oh, no shit.
So
was it Spike?
Spike was here, yeah. And then CJ was here.
Okay.
And then John Reese was here as well.
So they went through like a change, right? Because I don't know those guys very well, but I was on the Vans Warped Tour with that band, the whole tour in like 2003 they were on it. So I kind of was around them adjacent. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they, Fat Mike's no longer in the band, right?
No, Fat Mike's no longer in the band. Joey Cape's no longer in the band.
Right.
Like you're saying, I think they had like almost a complete overhaul at a certain point.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Not that John Reese isn't a great front person in his own right.
Yeah, totally.
But having a band full of lead singers... That's a suicide mission.
Yeah, right. Well, they used to have like the tiki bar on the side of the stage, and yeah, they're a great fucking band. Oh my god,
they're a great band. They're like, and I think Spike is one of the greatest front people of all time because he's almost like,
he was in Swinging Utters, right? Was that what?
He was in Swinging Utters, but I think that was after me first in the Gimme Gimmes.
Oh, okay.
I think he was just like really good at karaoke.
Right.
And that's how it all kind of came together for him. So
yeah.
So he doesn't have that lead singer ego, but Joey and Mike,
yeah,
they are lead singers. So I could, you know, I think it's a little more chill.
Yeah, 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 for days. Sure. He has like a little bit more control of the ship.
Yeah. But this is not about Joey Cape, Fat Mike, or Spike. This is about you and your journey, Chris. But I'm really intrigued by the fact that you have now produced two of my favorite documentaries this year.
Oh, wow.
In the documentary about your father. But then also you were involved in the production of the Bill Bartel documentary a little bit as well, too.
Right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I kind of... To go back, I know this guy, Jordan Schwartz. Shout out, Jordan.
Shout out to Jordan, yes.
We are Rip City locals. Rip City is a skate shop in Santa Monica. It's been around since 1978. And it was the place I got my first job. And I was in the eighth grade. And Jordan was like an old Rip City local, basically like a bar fly who'd hang out there all the time. And he would always be walking around, since I've been in the eighth grade, with one of his dogs coming in the shop, shooting the shit, and he was a punk rocker. And there was always kind of punk rock music adjacent ties to Rip City. And Dave Markey, who is the director of Secret Lives of Bill Bartel, he was also kind of a customer of the store. But I didn't come to know Dave later. It was really, you know, Jordan talking to me about Dave because they had that whole zine that they were doing.
We Got the Power.
Yeah, We Got Power.
We Got Power.
We Got Power, and then they would do the Weekly Journal, I think it was called, and it was basically like a local zine. But they just had the essence of punk rock, and Dave was looking for some help finishing the first pass of Secret Lives of Bill Bartel, and I'd never heard who Bill Bartel was. But I love stories of people who are connectors, who kind of bring a larger group of people in sync together. And then I always loved Dave's Slog video, which was like an old kind of collection of punk rock stuff. There's a Rip City commercial in it from... Rip City, historically, they did the Black Flag skateboard. I think the only Black Flag board that was ever really created. And there was four or five of them, and we had four of them at the store.
Oh, that's awesome.
Original Pettibone artwork, and it's kind of been its connection to punk rock. But Dave was looking to help finish the first pass of Secret Lives of Bill Bartel, and that's where I watched it. And like I was saying, Dave's like a connector, and I'm really, it was such a cool story. And I knew people who knew Bill. I actually had a fun experience with Kim Shattuck in Montreal at the Pooza Fest before, you know, she passed. Yeah, and it was Muffs were playing there, and I was playing in my friend's band, the Bruce Lee Band. And it was, the only reason I bring that up is because Kim was like, "Do you know Bill Bartel?" And I was like, "No." And so when I heard about the story, I thought of Kim. And so, yeah.
Yeah, Bill to me, like, I didn't know. I knew like White Flag, obviously. And I knew like, you know, like his place in the music industry. But until you see that documentary, until you see how much he connects of different things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I had Billy Idol on the show after Dave and Jordan were on.
Really?
Yeah. And telling Billy Idol, like, you know how Generation X got signed by Chris's manager? And he's like, "Well, yeah, because of blah blah blah." I'm like, no, it's not because of that, it's because of this. And just Billy Idol's like eyes opening up as he's finally able to put these pieces together.
Really? So you caught him in that moment?
Yeah, it was very it was like a real like interesting, and he's like, I could tell like legitimately kind of like, oh, that's how it happened, because the label was like, oh yeah, he just randomly reached out because he dug your guy's band. But it's like, no.
That was Bill O'Coin.
Yeah, Bill Bartel was putting in the legwork with Bill O'Coin to get Bill O'Coin to call Chrysalis. And that's why this whole thing came together. And it was just, yeah, like until you see that documentary. And I feel like you're saying, I love the connectors too and the people that join these kind of disparate scenes.
Yeah.
But I can't think of more disparate documentary subjects than your father's career versus Bill's career and what they kind of. But they both seem like
Bill is still showing up somehow, and now he's you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon to the John Candy documentary.
Yeah, but he's almost got, Bill's got this like, I finished that documentary and it's like, I feel like he was playing Dungeons and Dragons. I don't know what his alignment would be. Like, would it be...
Who, Bill?
Yeah, Bill, like chaotic neutral.
Bill. I think Bill was. After watching that doc several times, I think he was a like warm like a warm soul. I don't know, the kind of the table games there, but like, he was definitely, like, from what I picked up, like a very good person. But he was a contrarian for sure. I think he like looked at the like ridiculousness of life. And, I always find that interesting too. Like I had the observation with the way like he was ahead of his time, obviously, to talk about that, but there is this thing that's happening in the world, especially in the States, which is terrible, but like, where is counterculture? You know, you have like, you know, police officers with like black flag tattoos, mm-hmm. you know, it's mm-hmm. like, where is the true counterculture? And so I think a guy like Bill Bartel was like always able to see where it was and then be a few steps ahead of it, yeah. you know, being like, you know, oh, fucking cops are beating up punks, like, fuck the cops. And then he's like, well, I'm going to go be a cop, you know? Yeah. And it's like, what? And it's like, yeah, like, what's more punk than that? And so really tests the ethos of the whole ideology.
Yeah, like, his whole life was an art project, it seems. Like, just, like you're saying, like, from fetishizing police to becoming a cop to becoming this sort of, like, rodeo guy, which yeah. is ultimately, not to spoil it, but, like, you know, tied into his demise. Like, it's
sure.
like, it's like his whole life was kind of in service to this character that yeah. he was kind of constructing.
Totally. I think, and there are some similarities between the two documentaries with Bill's and my dad's, but I think inevitably the only, you know, the Bill story is super duper interesting because like he didn't have the pressures of fame on him and he kind of just behaved however the hell he wanted to behave. And, you know, but I think maybe in the abuse of Diet Cokes and all of that stuff, and maybe Bill got into drugs later and stuff. And my dad with, you know, alcohol and food and cigarettes and stuff like that. Like, I think there was that you could connect the dots of like, silencing anxieties and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No, I think it all comes down to mental health
yeah.
stuff.
And you're like totally right.
How you treat it.
Yeah.
And I think comedy and punk are like light bulbs that kind of attract the right. moths with mental health issues. I say this with a mental health issue moth kind of floating sure. around in my brain. Like,
yeah, same.
Like we find, because there's like an outlet
yeah.
through these things that you can kind of do yeah. on your own in a lot of ways. Like you don't really need to rely on like being on a team to necessarily make it. You can kind of like write your own destiny a little bit.
Totally. A lot of us are just out there kind of like working through our shit, and some of us still are doing it. It's like, but yeah, a lot of the early music when I got into like writing music, and I never had any really popular band to the listeners out there, but I did play in a handful of punk rock bands, and like for sure, like it was just so much aggression and anger, and like, but I'm like, I look back on it now and I'm like so stoked that that's the way it went out, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like that's like the positive way you, know, you can put this kind of anger
sure.
and stuff, because I've got definitely I got friends or people that maybe didn't find that outlet and didn't
yeah.
become very nice people later in,
for sure.
in their lives. Is there, you know, and I've had a lot of people on this podcast that were maybe not nice people, but kind of through the process of being into this music,
yeah,
gained some sensitivities and learned about other people and stuff. But yeah. how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
It was really through ska music first, I think. I have an early memory of watching that movie Back to the Beach, which was Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this like kind of 80s like post surf, you know,
oh,
like
yeah.
bizarro post modern beach flick. Kind of making fun of the genre of like the old school Beach Bunny tracks, and like Fishbone had a song, Jamaica Ska, on it that they covered with Annette. And I just remember being like a kid, like, this is the best music ever. And I just like loved that scene. And that whole movie's kind of got like SoCal vibes all over it. And there's like the punks, like the surfer punks and all that. And
yeah, so
that,
like Paul Rubens in it too.
Pee Wee Herman.
I saw the theater when it came out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such like, I own it on iTunes. It's just like a funny movie. And, it started there and really started with ska and like third wave ska music. And then I had a friend who lived down in Orange County. They had a really big ska scene in the '90s, like kind of post No Doubt, into like, there was all kinds of different avenues of that happening. But through that, I would like come up on punk bands and stuff. And that was really the beginning of it. I think like early stuff I was listening to. Well, the first punk record I ever got was Operation Ivy, for sure.
Yeah.
And that was, like, really the gateway drug, because it was just, like, that was ska. It was also hardcore, in a sense, and that was really the beginning of it. But it was all kind of within that world, and, like, in my time, which is probably, like, a later time for you, it was, like, punk and ska were kind of married in the mid-90s, and, you know, a bunch of bands would play shows together, and so it wasn't, like, weird to be at, like, you know, a gig, and it was, like, Blue Meanies and, you know, or who was it that opened for them one time? I'm trying to remember. It would just be a hybrid of bands playing together. It wouldn't just be, like, a full-on ska show. It'd be, like, a ska band, and, like, Agnostic Front would be playing.
Yeah, like, Buddha Glow Skulls would play with, like, all sorts of different types of bands.
Yeah, too. Exactly. And, yeah,
like,
yeah.
There was, like, a lot more... Yeah, like, it felt like it obviously got eventually big enough that you could kind of sustain itself, separate scene.
My friend George Walker, who also worked at Rip City, he doesn't remember it, but he took me, he was like a chaperone for me, because my mom would, like, I didn't have, like, he just, like, needed an adult to go, and like, he's, like, the perfect adult for that, Rip City local. But he took me to a Keith Morris benefit show, and it was Nashville Pussy, Fishbone, The Vandals, and Pennywise, I think, played that show.
That's an awesome show.
Yeah, it was just like, and like, that's also where I, like, saw Fishbone for the first time. I was just fucking blown away by them. They're a big band for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's kind of the beginning, and then I always, like, was trying to start bands, and I had a punk band in eighth grade, or a ska band, and then I, you know... I think when I was in my college years, like, I really got into Bad Brains and proper hardcore and stuff. Like, my high school band, sorry, I'm jumping all over the place, but I was in this band with this dude, Kevin Preston is really his name, but Kevin now plays backup guitar for Green Day. He's their, like, onstage guitar player.
Awesome. And I was, like, wondering, like, I'm like, oh, there's another guitar player now too. There's Jason there as well. And so... My youngest kid, who you met upstairs, is a massive, massive Green Day fan.
Oh, cool. So yeah.
We went to the show. And
oh, well, yeah. Was it good?
That was cool. It was very, very cool. Like, it was like, I'd seen Green Day, I guess, on the Warped Tour one time, but I never got to see him, like, actually play any sort of the earlier stadium kind of shows, so.
I was actually talking to Todd Congelier. I'm going to be name dropping all over this podcast.
That's what this podcast is, believe me. That's all I do on it.
Todd's a buddy of mine, and he's, like, the punk rock mastermind of SoCal, in my opinion. He's, like, the godfather of SoCal punk. And he was talking to me about going with his daughter to, like, I think they went and saw, like, Mac DeMarco, or I can't remember, but we're talking about going to bigger shows.
Yeah.
And it's like, kind of a trip, but it's also kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know, because it's, like, we've been to so many club gigs and all the shit, and it's, like, to go to these, like, big produced things, you know? He said he was having a good time with it.
It was cool. Like, I got to see, and shout out to Todd. You're right. Todd's, like, one of the greatest legends of all time.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, like, I feel like you're saying, it's like a visit into another world that I, like, kind of willingly left. And no slight on these bands, because they're doing their best they can at it. But the way you interact with it is so different than where, I guess, we ultimately went.
Yeah.
That, I saw Weezer, because Dinosaur Jr. opened.
Oh, sick.
And then, luckily, I interviewed Pin at Gunpowder and got Green Day tickets after that.
Oh,
like,
whoa.
So I feel like I got at least in below the $1,000 threshold it would have been to get in there.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy how much tickets go for.
It's wild. It's very, like, and I feel like you just kind of have to do it, because I think everyone saw with The Cure, like, how much of a fight it is to, like, lower your ticket price.
Right, because they always try to keep it affordable, those guys.
And, and it's not always in your hands, I guess.
There's alternative ticket sites I think people are starting to use, and, like, they don't have to go through Ticketmaster necessarily, or you know, I feel like I'm starting to see more of that to keep the tickets, like, affordable for people.
Yeah, but I feel like there's, like, been so much vertical integration in that kind of space, that, like, you got a venue that's kind of controlled by the people that have the relationship with the ticketing place. And
there's a board game about it somewhere.
Yeah. I'm lucky that my band never got to the level of popularity that I really have to worry about it.
I know. My last band, we had, like, all the drama of Metallica and none of the success.
Yeah. That basically describes my band too. Yeah. In a nutshell. It's like, It's like you watch that some kind of monster, and you're like, oh, that's nothing.
Yeah, I know.
That's baby shit compared to what we're dealing with over here. But
I will say, just to the high school band, Kevin plays now with Green Day, but what I was getting at is, like, we were, like, I wanted it to so be, like, a ska band, but the guitar player, Kevin, really wanted it to be more like a Rocket from the Crypt thing, and we had a singer who was really, he's passed away now, but his name is Mike Domingo, but he was really into the Valley and, like, Oxnard, like, hardcore scene. He was this Filipino kid with,
Narcore,
like,
stuff?
Yeah, oh, he was fucking into, like, he had the big plugs in his ears, and he was straight edge, and, like, he just was, like, into all of those bands, so his scream was really primal and really good, and, like, so I got exposed to all different avenues of what the scene was offering at the time, and it's just, you know, it's I'm not finished, it's just, like, you know, now I'm in, like, Bill Bartell land, and I'm, like, listening to Red Cross more regularly, and I'm listening to, going back and listening to, you know, Muffs, and you know, I'm learning about a lot of the older LA bands, which has been fun, because my early start was, like, you know, OC ska scene, Fishbone, Up Ivy, and then we can talk about it in a bit, like, the big kind of avenue and chapter for me is my friend Mike Park, who owns Asian Men Records. He's, like, my brother, and he really is introduced me and exposed me to a ton of music and stuff like that.
And also, like, another person that connects so many
big time
different things.
Yeah, he's his own Bill Bartell, Mike Park, for sure.
Yeah, like, I think for, like, a different era and a different scene, and generally a different kind of disposition than Bill Bartell. I never met Bill Bartell, but I feel like...
Right, I never did either, yeah.
There's a real... Like, that's the thing. When I finished that documentary, I'm like, it's such a great documentary because you don't come out loving necessarily Bill Bartell.
Right.
This is a flawed, very interesting human being.
But yeah.
No one really knows this guy. He could have 100%... been a CIA agent. Like, that's, like, by the end of it's done, it's like, was he a CIA guy?
Yeah, exactly. Who is this guy really reporting back to? Yeah, he was, yeah. Mike is similar to that. He's a little bit more, you're not worried about him working for a foreign government or anything like that.
No, but he's lawful good, not chaotic neutral.
Have you met Mike before?
I've never met him, but he's certainly someone that I've, like, read about, and, you know, obviously the bands over the years.
Skank and Pickle
all the way up to, like, you know, stuff. And, like, there's been a lot of people that have been on the podcast that have put out records.
Right.
On Asian Man Records. Yeah. And, yeah, like, he's someone that, I you know, it just never happened. Like, I feel like that's the thing about this podcast is, like, there's just so many different facets to dive into.
Sure.
And, yeah, it's someone I would love to have on the show. So, at some point, I would love to have him on because it's, yeah, like, a deep, deep connector of all these, like, wild worlds from, like, Daniel Steele to, like, the Broadways to...
Well, yeah, and then he was, like, yeah, his like, connectivity to ska and what he's doing with Bruce Lee Band and like, trying to, like... I mean, what I'm getting at was, like, he's always, like, putting Fishbone on, like, trying to help them out as much, and, like, they're such a band that has had so many chapters and they're going through one right now, but, like, I always thought it was cool that he would, like, get, like, Angelo to, like, guest on, like, a Bruce Lee Band track and, like, kind of keep them relevant within in the world and stuff, because I always just feel like those older bands that, like, didn't really get their full, like, they're not going out in the way, like, Faith No More probably will go out and do shows, or, like, obviously Chili Peppers, but, like, they should, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's cool that they kind of get, like, the DIY blessing, which is, like, really cool.
Yeah, they feel like the band that is so much more important than they kind of get the place in, like, American music history.
Totally.
Like, for, like you're saying, like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers to No Doubt to, like, all the things they inspired to being in movies to being part of, like, the LA kind of punk scene when it was kind of at its maybe most treacherous times.
Yeah, totally.
And, yeah, like a hugely influential band. A band that we've worked many times to try and get on the show. And have had different scenarios kind of play out that have prevented that from happening. But still, like, my brother was just talking to me about it the other day. Like, I think we're going to finally be able to do it.
So, that's great.
Yeah, it would be a huge thrill because there's all these people that I feel like the ripples these people cause. Let's try and fix that.
I got it.
Sorry about this.
No, it's all good.
This is a very much, I'm going to be like, okay, well, I definitely need a new thing stand. Phone stand.
I think this will work.
It's got like a... Like a,
I like it. That works.
It's like that SCTV all fake our... 3D effect going on.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, Fishbone's the best. They're just like, they should, actually, honestly, they're doing exactly what they need to be doing right now. And they're in a great place, and they're playing, like, you know, how many bands can say that they get to play a lot of these fun festivals or go and do these tours and have the people come out? Like, they've just gone through so many different, like, versions, so.
Yeah, I think that becomes, like...
I'd love Norwood to be back in the band, but...
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things to do as a band is, like, how do you keep everyone together?
Yeah.
And how do you keep these different personalities? Because it's like a marriage on steroids.
It fully is, yeah, yeah. Like, where you just, like, love and hate everybody at, like, various moments of the day, almost. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, as someone who's spent way too much time with the band members, and I think we all know way too much about each other's inner deficiencies. And
totally.
And it's, I understand it now. Like, at times when I would see band members leave a band, I'd be like, those fucking assholes. Or, like, you know,
yeah.
You pick a side. It'd be really easy to pick a side.
Yeah, it is. It's funny. Yeah, I noticed that. And that's what I was getting at with Mike, too, is, like, we kind of have always treated Fishbone like a little, like, telenovela or something, like, you know, like a daytime soap of, like, what's going on? Like, what's the new news?
Yeah.
Who's back in the band? Oh, man, like, you know, Spacey T's back in. Like, we just, like... We're it's like trading stats, you know. We're always in on the story, and it's fun for us. But they still sound great, you know.
Yep.
And I'm really like stoked that they were like a big influence for me for sure. But yeah, that kind of is it. Like with punk, like it started that way, and then like I had a band in eighth grade called Bay Street Hooligans. In high school, it was called Optimus Prime, that then turned into Sleeper Hold. And we were really, you know, I was really influenced by all, like, the Asian Man stuff. And I was just basically, like, I was going to record stores and I would, like, look in the thank you sections of all of the CDs. And that's how I'd find out about new bands.
Yeah.
That's how I would find out about, like, you know, whomever it was, like, that I was trying to get into. And so I'm just also trying to think back to bands that I was listening to at the time. But it was really, like, huge Asian Man record stuff. I was just really into that stuff.
It's interesting in Southern California because
Voodoo Glow Skulls for sure.
Well, and it's so popular.
Yeah.
Like that there's like ways that you can almost fall into like a different tract. I think in like
yeah.
Toronto it was a lot smaller, so it felt like
yeah.
everything would have to mix a little bit more at times.
I noticed that too when I would come back up, like so like historically, like I moved to Los Angeles with my family when I was like 2 years old. And I more or less grew up in Los Angeles, but when my dad was alive, we would be back and forth between Los Angeles and Canada.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So I have real strong roots to Canada and Toronto, and I feel like I'm a Canadian before an American often. But I feel really strong ties to LA, mm-hmm. and just because I grew up there. And with that, it's like, when I would come up here to go to shows, I remember like Warped Tour would be here and I'd go or I'd check it out. And then I'd be in bands and we played a skate shop here in this band Bomb the Music Industry that I played trumpet in. That was this band, this guy, Jeff Rosenstock. It was his
yeah,
old band.
Yeah, for sure. Where'd you guys, what skate shop would that have been?
It
oh, Adrift.
In Kensington Market.
Yeah, Adrift.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's wild you guys played there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we played one place in Montreal too. I remember, I think it was in, well, we played Montreal and Quebec City. But I had touched like the Canadian Toronto mm-hmm. punk rock scene a bit, and it did seem more mixed. Like LA definitely was like the punk shows were different than the ska shows, and there wasn't too much crossover. And like, I also grew up in a time too when like, L.A. didn't really have a ton of... House shows were a thing. There was the smell in downtown L.A. where you could go, and you were never cool enough to play there. And, you know, you'd, like, have to be, like, super unique to go play shows there.
Also seems like it was adversarial with the punk scene at different times, too. Like
yeah.
It's a separate scene.
It was. It was. It's L.A. art-influenced, performative noise. Like, there wasn't room really for like a hardcore band or whatnot. And as time, that stuff changes. Yeah. Now that I know that, like, my friend's band Let Live, they're very big now, but like, they played The Smell, and I was like, Let Live played The fucking Smell? Like, that never would have happened back in like 1998 or 2003, or it just wouldn't have happened. They were a band in 98, but
there was a Dystopia show, and there was like a riot at the show.
Yeah,
and that was apparently like the hard cutoff.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Then they, yeah. There was a place in Echo Park called Echo Curio that would do shows as I was getting older that were, what I'm getting at is those were kind of the beacons of like independent stuff. And it was really connected to KXLU, which is, I do a radio show there still every Wednesday. It's called Noise Pollution. And that, the KXLU's influence on LA music scene was very apparent, but that was always blended. It wasn't like fully punk and like, or ska, for that matter. And so that you had that scene going on in LA, and then you also had like just the fucking like Whiskey a Go Go, Roxy, pay to play bullshit, and we did it, you know, because there were places to play, and like Optimus Prime or Sleeper Hold, whatever we were called at the time, we played all of those spots, and you'd get like fucking tickets, and it just, it felt so wrong, but you know, you got to get that moment, and it, so it was either those shows or house shows. And that was like what we would do, and now looking back on it, I'm like, oh, okay, this is like, was going in the direction of like putting on your own shows, or then people like got old enough to open like rad venues like the Sardine, you know, and so that's where it evolved into that.
Yeah, and I feel like those pay to play shows are almost like the spurning on that you need to kind of go and start doing your own shows,
because like, those kind of suck. Like, you're just like, oh yeah, like. I love, my mom still goes to, and she's been to some fucking shows.
Yeah.
Like, I gotta give her so much credit, because she's just like downstairs of like a weird punk venue in Chicago with like, you know, like the Second City people, and I have respect for them. They did some wild stuff. Like, it was organized, but like, they, you know, I always looked at my mom in this way of like, she was so like, not delicate is the wrong word, but she's your mom. You know what I mean? But then you realize, like, who she kicked it with and who she was around. It's like, oh, yeah, she could go to anything. Yeah. Like, no problem, you know?
Yeah, they were, like, doing way crazier drugs at that point than anyone can do now. Like, Quaaludes, like, drugs they took off the market. They were so crazy.
Yeah. She was around all of that. Who knows if she did any of it, but I don't think so.
My parents definitely did.
Really?
Yeah.
My mom, I think, I'll just say my dad was around all of it, and I'm sure experimented on enough of it, but he was never hooked on any of that stuff. But my mom, I think, I know my mom never did Quaaludes.
Yeah.
Because she told me, never do Quaaludes. I almost watched a man die on Quaaludes. And I'll tell that story to friends, and they will be like, that's insane. Like, no one does those.
Yeah. You can't find lewds anymore. They're like off the market.
No, it wasn't since that Wolf of Wall Street movie did they kind of come back in the like in the zeitgeist.
People are trying to get them. I think there's like one place in the world they still make it or something. I've looked into it. Yeah, like
let's do them.
Yeah, let's find some quaaludes and party. It's because my parents were in Toronto.
Okay.
Like, not part of the SCTV kind of circle, but, like, definitely kind of, like, concentric kind of, like, kind of worlds. My dad was in the sort of the advertising world,
and
my mom was a flight attendant. But they were, like, you know, my dad was saying that he used to see your dad and kind of, like, the kind of SCTV people would always cold court at Mr. Green Jeans.
Oh, yeah. No way. Wow. Yeah.
And there was, like, a table that they had where they would all go sit and kind of work on stuff. And
yeah, that sounds...
You'd always see him there.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. PNC's apply, in app only.
Yeah, I've been feeling it, and since, you know, I've been up here because the movie's playing at TIFF for the listeners. It opened the festival. The movie's called John Candy, I Like Me. During production and then, like, anytime I've been up here, I definitely feel that energy of how cool Toronto must have been in the 70s, of being able to just like bump around. And like, it's a very walkable city up here. Yeah. And like, it's big, but it's also super tiny. Duper small.
Yeah. Especially circles of people in like media or entertainment or the arts.
Yeah.
I find it's like everyone knows somebody through somebody type yeah. thing.
Full on.
It's, I recently learned, well, actually, I recently relearned that Peter Aykroyd, Dan Aykroyd's brother,
yeah.
Was in a band with Freddie Pompey from the Viletones.
Oh, really?
Yeah, called Wheelchair. And it's pre-Viletones, kind of pre-punk, but they would have been kind of like an SCTV kind of like adjacent, like yeah. blues rock band, I guess.
Well, you know, it's funny, like, I didn't know that, and but it makes sense because those, when it's your family, you're like, oh, and that kind of goes back to the counterculture thing I was talking about. It's like, I'm doing something that's different. But then it's like, I had a good relationship with George Wendt before he passed away. Just, you know, friendly, and we would message each other all the time. And he totally loved punk.
Like, yeah, he was like a huge Replacements fan, right?
Big Replacements fan, but like, we would play, my current band, Bull Shannon, we would play down in, yeah.
That's Bull awesome, Shannon. Yeah.
We could talk about it. It's my favorite band name. But we've only played like a handful of shows, but I would tell him like, yeah, we're playing down like at the Sardine or before he passed, and he'd always try and make it out.
That's awesome.
And he had a point of view on it too. He was just like, yeah, you know what? I like the Minutemen a little bit more than Firehose. They just had that punch, you know? And like, he just knew, you know, it was like someone who kind of knew what they were talking about. So, and then this guy, Tino Insana, who was from Chicago, he was my dad's good friend. He was a voiceover actor later before he passed away. Again, though, they'd go see Fear. They would go to, you know, they knew, you know, all. He was like, oh, yeah, my buddy Lee Ving and Fear, you know, they're playing Warped Tour, or you should go meet them. Or like, and you don't get it because you think that that's like your parents' job,
yeah.
you know, like yeah. being a flight attendant or whatever. But then you don't realize, like, they were in the fucking wackiest avenue of comedy that was happening. And so, of course, they know the punks, or, you know, like, of course they know that stuff. And I always thought that that was, like, a cool kind of, like, level-up moment for me where I was like, oh, yeah, like, they all get it, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like comedy is as much an influence on punk as music is.
Sure.
Like, it's the idea of, like, subverting music, and it's always... That's why punk is kind yeah. of immune to parody.
Yeah.
Because you can't be sillier than someone in a punk band already has been. Like, Kill the Poor has already been written. Like, you right. can't parody this thing.
Yeah.
Because it's always going to be kind of in on the joke. So, everyone that comes on this podcast talks about SCTV.
Really?
Yeah, like, it's just, like, foundational.
Well, it's funny you say that, because that's, like, Mike Watt came up to do Noise Pollution with me a couple times, and I was really insecure about, like, my dad and being related to my dad and having this kind of like huge fancy celebrity kind of like, I didn't know where to place it. So,
yeah.
And I think I was, wanting to just like forever. And I still do that, wanting to like let everybody know who I am, you know, like who you're talking to and all of that stuff. And I'm much more like cool with all of it, way cooler with it now as I'm older. But, when I was like 20, it was tough. And, but I remember Mike came up to KXLU. And we did the show, and then he, like, was walking down the hallway at KXLU, and he, like, turned around and looked at me, and he was like, your dad's in the TV business, isn't he? And I was like, yeah, his name was John Candy. He was this actor. He's like, Johnny LaRue! Yeah! I couldn't really tell if it was real or not. And I was like, oh, God, like, awesome. I was just kind of like, it was like a very, like, glass break moment for me where I was like, fuck, who cares, you know?
Yeah.
And so I remembered that being a good memory for sure of the crossroads of it all.
That was amazing watching the documentary, just how much of my life I can place from different films.
Yeah.
And being like, oh, that was my favorite movie at this age, and that was right. my favorite thing at this age. And like, I grew up on SCTV reruns, but
right.
like, that was my show. Like,
yeah.
I would just, like, every day watch SCTV at 6:30, no matter what.
I thought that the doc did a good job of talking about SCTV, too.
Yes.
I feel like a lot of people are going to come away from watching it going like, I want to know more about that show.
There are two pieces, though, that didn't make it into the film that I feel like involve your dad that are so key to punk history.
Oh, yeah.
The Plasmatics.
Yeah, yeah.
With Gil.
Yeah.
Segment, which is just, I went back and rewatched for this other thing I'm kind of working on, and just, it's such an amazing moment because I feel like, it's funny, I'm talking to this director who's actually working on a project about it right now, and we were talking about that, where you really get to see Wendy kind of be humanized a little bit in front of the camera, which is not something that happened very often.
Yeah, that's true. They did. Was it an interview with them?
It was like they came on the show and they go out with him, and it's like a whole bit, like a whole like day of shooting. It looks like
It's funny. I saw that we have a Plasmatics record at the house that they signed, and I haven't gone deep enough in the SCTV world. I know that they had the fake punk band.
They did, which the Queen haters. But like, you've got to take a picture of that record. I would love to see that.
Yeah, yeah, oh, I'll find amazing. It. I'll dig it up.
Yeah, they did the Queen haters with "I Hate the Bloody Queen," which is actually the band the Young Lions playing the music for.
Oh, okay.
They were like a local punk band. I got their demo somewhere over here.
Oh, but I didn't know the history of that.
Yeah, and apparently, according to legend, when they finished recording it, they were like, "Hey guys, that's great, but can you play it again? Shittier, because we need to be a little sloppier for the gag to land."
That is awesome.
Those are my two of my favorite punk comedy crossover cultural moments.
I know it's trying to get that's the difficulty with I Like Me, is that you are trying to get so much in, and the main goal with that one for me was to really get across the nuance of what he grappled with in his life.
Yeah.
And that was like, excuse me, the main goal.
There's plenty of reasons not to have those scenes in the movie. I'm not saying don't see this movie because those didn't make it. Because I think you're right. Like, there's the thing that I related to a lot, which I think was why I responded so much to the movies over the years that your dad did, was because I was a big kid, and eventually everyone caught up with me.
Yeah.
But being the big kid, I was always like, there's no, like, I related to seeing a big person on screen.
Yeah.
And it's a different kind of attention you attract as a bigger person.
Yeah.
Than, you know, like, everyone's like, "Hey, big guy." Like, automatically got that nickname.
Yeah. What's up, big guy? Or,
Yeah,
I totally can relate, because I grew up as a big kid and was like grappled with weight, and clothes didn't fit the way you wanted them to and all that shit. And I know that was, the movie does a really good job, I think, of like explaining what he was up against with that stuff, because it really played on him, and it forced him into like a corner, I think, that it would not be fun for anyone to be in regards to how to carry yourself throughout the world.
It also exposes how terrible Canadian interviewers
are. We got to save it for people who see it, but yeah, it's
nuts.
It's fucked. It's like, so it's so crazy. Fucked. Yeah, you just, like, when I saw the first edit, I was just like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
Like, how, like, and, but you know it, because you're Canadian, there is this, like, there, and maybe there still is, or there was, but this, like, yeah, we're buddies. Like, I'm cracking a joke with the comedy guy. And you're like, oh my God, like.
There's a tall poppy syndrome in Canada that's not really talked about, because, like, there's a certain level that you ascend to where people just assume they know you. And there's, like, almost like, I'm going to chop this person down to my size as soon as they get into this thing.
I've never heard of it. That's so, that is so accurate, because it's kind of hard to explain. It's like, I've always noticed that there's this, like, Canadians are super polite, and I have to say, like, coming from Los Angeles, where we have, like, fucking nightmare, you know, ICE Gestapo raids going on, you know, and all the terribleness that's happening down there, it's like, we now, you know, it's like, you come into this country, and you don't have to deal with that at all, and you don't have, like, you're in a place where people respect each other, and there's, like, a tolerance for everybody, but there is this through line of, like, yeah, all right, I'm not gonna let you get too high.
Yeah, like, it's like a very tolerant place, maybe not accepting at times in some ways.
Yeah,
like,
I agree. Yeah,
and I feel like, and when I say Canada, I mean Toronto. I think Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto. Yeah, well, It's cool though. Like, I don't know. You go into like, it's just balance. I don't know. Maybe if I stayed here long enough, I would sense more what you're talking about. But I just, I've always explained Toronto as like the doorstep to the world a bit more, since it's such a melting pot and there's so many different cultures, and it's just like, it doesn't, you know, I know racism and all of that stuff still exists in Canada and it's definitely still a problem, but like, as it does in America and all that stuff, but like, I feel like there, it's just, it's different than what I think you come across sometimes in the States. It just is. I will definitely agree to that point for sure.
Yeah. Like
There's a sense of like the country's trying to turn the boat around, at least, yeah, of like, it may be a slow turn, but we're going to like acknowledge native cultures and we're going to do this part of like, we're going to at least do that. And like, there's such a blind eye happening stateside. That's like not for me, but like, you know, the people I associate with, but like, you know, when you come up here, it's just like, that part is really great. But then, yeah, there's also the just like, oh yeah, so Johnny Toronto, huh? You're really coming up in the world, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I don't think so. I don't know.
And I feel like it's also people like, they know you, right? Yeah. Like, I'm watching that and like, heard about, you know, when the mention of Donlands, a theater on Donlands.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Like, oh, I'm like, that's my neighborhood. Like, there's a familiarity that which breeds contempt a little bit in like a way that you're just like,
oh yeah, big time.
And especially in the media space where someone makes it. And you're like, I'm still trapped here.
Yeah. We get that too. So, I mean, a lot of Canadians wish, I think he was buried up here, but you know, I'm really happy. He's in like Inglewood, Westchester area. And it's a beautiful place. And it's just like, yeah, but he's good. He's by the beach. He's chilling, you know?
Why does he like the Islanders? Why was that his team? Do you know?
I don't know, actually. I don't know the reason for that. Oh, all good. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Because like, it's such a Toronto thing to love Toronto hockey, and I definitely was not a fan of it as a kid.
So. Right. He was a fan of football, obviously. He was a fan of sports, but he was pretty loyal, I think. You know, I will say this, though. Like, I remember him just ingesting sports. Like, I think so, you know. He was, you know, when I was a kid, it was like Kings games and, you know, a ton of Argonaut stuff. But, you know, baseball game would be on. He just kind of, I remember, it's funny, like, this is actually a funny story, but like when in the process for this movie, we had to digitize a lot of stuff. And then it was also like there's so much, but then we had to find more. You have to find as much as you can. And so when he passed away, he had a production house in an office that was on the west side of LA, and everything got boxed up and sent to this place called Iron Mountain, which is like a very nice organized storage facility, and just kind of sat there for years, you know. And my mom just like, I knew it was there, and I had to go in and kind of work on it a little bit, but with this process, really working through all of it. But you get to the like the tapes that have no label on it. Like, there was like one tape that had, I think, like Manson's face on it, or it was just like, you know, like the and you're like, fuck, what, like, you know, every kid's nightmare is he's gonna find his dad's porn or something like that, you know. It's like, so you're like, fuck, all right, here it is. So I go, can I watch these videos, you know? I just need to know what's on them.
Yeah.
And so we go up to, they have like a screening place, and I'm so fucking nervous. I'm like, god damn it. And then, but whatever, all right, let's just go. And so we start popping him in, and it's like, you forget the era he was alive. They taped hockey games or boxing matches because they didn't have it on the YouTube.
Yeah.
So it's like 90% of them were sporting events. And then the Manson tape was actually just the court story of the Manson thing that was just like on it. And I was like, okay, like, you know.
Phew.
And the knock, it's like, the knock we had with this project was like, did you go deep enough? And I'm like, I'm positive we did, because like, I mean, unless, you know, but it's just like that who he was. He was a pretty good dude who had some real human demons that he grappled with that we all do.
Yep. No, and obviously I lost my mom at a very different time in my life, but when I lost my mom, going through her stuff and just finding out about things that I'm like, huh, that's a whole side of her that I didn't know existed. And she's like a human being. And so, of course, these sides of her
existed.
Are there. But just as a kid, you're never like,
yeah,
I wonder what my mom keeps under her bed.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And when they pass, you have to grapple with that.
Yes.
And so the movie shares a little bit of that. But, you know, that's the... Yeah, I understand.
I kind of want to put notes on certain records in this record collection, being like, now here's why this is here. Before you judge, you know, just like, listen.
I know. It's so true. It's like, yeah, he was totally a curious dude. So it was just like fully like, yeah. But yeah, nothing super crazy. We looked everywhere, at least what we had and stuff like that. So
yeah, no, it definitely, it's fun. I've had a couple people on that have made documentary projects about parents who've passed away, and just like it's something that not anyone would get to do, like dive into your family like that.
It's true.
And it's like, I before my mom passed away, she was on the podcast.
Awesome.
I'm so glad I had that investigation into them, because like, you know, you try and understand who these people are. And especially like once you have kids, you lose your individuality in a lot of ways, but like you are still this very random person.
It's true. Yeah. You, and you're learning about them as a person. That's so cool. You got that time to do that. That's the best.
It's like one of the only things that I'm like, have procrastinated on, and then eventually just been like, fuck it, let's do it. And I'm like, just like, damn it. I'm glad I did that.
Good.
With my mom and my dad, and it's just there's like a lot of people that you just like, that's kind of why I started the podcast, because there's just so many people in my life, more on a professional basis, like making music, that I'm like, I would love to like just like really find out the minutia of their experience to a level that is just not socially acceptable to do in any other situation but a podcast.
It's true. I remember saying to the director Colin, I was talking to a friend, I was like, this is I'm very fortunate that this opportunity is here right now. And I don't ever want to come across like I'm taking it for granted, you know? And so, but I just was very honored to get the opportunity, the funding, all of the stuff to be able to get this for me, because like I would end up getting like to sit in, I sat in on like 80% of the interviews. And you know, you would just get a set of headphones, and I've said it before in interviews, but it was like getting a 2-hour podcast by Dave Thomas about your dad, or a 2-hour podcast from Catherine O'Hara, or his best friend, or, you know, it's like, Pat Kelly, like just, you get these really intimate conversations. And then that's also where, if you go broad enough in the process, like you start to see the things that are true. Mm-hmm. You just can circle them, 'cause you've interviewed now at that point, like 30 people. And it's like, they're all saying this, or they're all saying this. And then there was a time where I was like, no one's really wanting to go deep. So then it was like, as me helping, going like, these two people will go deep, you know, let's go to them now. And that really helped. But I will say, just for people, when they do get a chance, it comes out on Prime on the 10th. And then if you don't want to do that, it's going to be going to, place a few festivals. It's playing festivals now, and then it's going to be, Ryan Reynolds is doing this cool little promo tour with it, where all the money is going to St. Jude's.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, there's going to be, like, if you want to see it in theater, that's what I mean. He's going to be playing a few, like, L.A., New York, Toronto again, and all of that stuff. But yeah, so, it was a great experience, for sure, so.
Yeah, because it feels like, you know, like I look at the people in it, right? Like everyone has this relationship where they kind of wanted to say nice things. Like people that aren't notoriously nice behind the scenes, and people I've even interacted with that weren't very nice behind the scenes, all said very nice things. And, you know, that was like you're saying, there's certain things you can kind of circle on.
And a lot of people, that's how they behave. There's an observation in this about generations. You know, one generation doesn't really like to go certain places, and then your generation, mine, it's maybe a little easier to kind of talk about that kind of stuff. And that was kind of the main objective with it. But yeah, it was totally an honor to be able to do it, and I'm happy that it turned out the way it did. I'm very happy with the way it is.
Do you want to do more documentaries? Is that your kind of like thing you kind of want to work in? Or
yeah, I mean, I produced this, and I produced Bill Bartel. Bill Bartel more on like a last. It was like final phases. Mm-hmm. I had just come off directing some music videos for Coldplay, actually, of all things.
I saw that.
Yeah.
They seem like super nice people.
No, they're great. And there's a funny story with them. But like in the midst of all the Coldplay stuff and how they're in this bubble of like pop and rock and all of this stuff, they're the greatest guys. Their stage manager is this guy named Paul Trainer, I believe. He was like, what I have a respect for with that band is they're a huge, operation. Like, it's crazy. It's just like a city travels with them. But their stage manager was this British dude who was like, he was Motorhead's sound guy. He was like a roadie for Motorhead, and he was like telling the craziest Motorhead stories to me. It was just like, and all of those dudes are like hanging out, like they work really hard, but then they kind of like, they party hard, you know, yeah. They're like the crew dudes, and it's like a city of crew people. And you didn't hear it from me, but there's a rumor there's like little bars underneath the stage where they're all hanging out having darts and fucking shooting them back. But he was like telling me, he was like, he's working the whole show, this guy, though. He's and I only met him once, so I don't want to speak like he's my best buddy, but he was sharing all these stories, and like he was telling about working for Lemmy, and Lemmy would throw like a bag of speed and like two bottles of vodka on the boat, on the bus, and be like, this has got to be gone by the morning. And all the like roadies would be like finding clever ways to hide it, because they just couldn't, if they, you know, they
couldn't party anymore.
No way. Yeah, you know, like, you know, like maybe first night to, I don't know. It was, I always thought that was a funny story. But you're hearing it in like the midst of like the Coldplay universe, which is totally opposite.
Yeah,
very nice people though. Yeah,
they have a self-release 7-inch too. That's like, I've never seen a copy in real life.
Oh, is that the one that just came out?
No, like they did it way back. Oh. The first record they ever did was like a self-release 7-inch.
Huh.
I remember hearing about in like, you know, Rarest Records in like the early 2000s. And I'm like, wow, you think over the years, like I've seen a Butcher Baby Beatles record. I've seen like most of these records, yeah. But yeah, I'm like, that thing just never turns up. I guess Coldplay fans are...
They're it's huge. Like it's like a Michael Jackson level, like kind of like the... atmosphere and the like kind of world of it, but
it's like 100, like we were on a tour with the Foo Fighters and it was like 100 people on the tour, like,
yeah,
executives, catering, like
exactly, it's it feels like that. We got to go down to Australia, my girlfriend and I, and we work on these videos together, and yeah, it was cool. But, you know, to circle it back to Dave Markey, it's like that's kind of like how it works sometimes. Like you're a punk or you're into that kind of music, and like, of course you're going to go work in these like bigger atmospheres or these other universes. Like that's what they want. They want people who kind of have like a little bit of an idea of, not just their world, you know, to kind of add some flavor to what they're cooking. So I don't know. I guess I say that cause I was so like, punk is so, you know, like it really is a state of mind to me, mm-hmm. as opposed to like the way you look nowadays. And so, I think if you're a good person, I think if you're going through life with like honesty and love, that's like the most punk rock thing you could do. And so it's like all good, you know, and that's how I kind of view it now as I keep getting older and stuff.
It's like a religion. It is like,
it kind of is. Yeah, it's true.
It never leaves you once you kind of get affected by it. And it's, I don't know. I definitely, you know, it's interesting when you meet people that have gone so far in their journey.
Yeah.
But there's certain shorthands where if you bring up Gigi Allen or Ian MacKay or Jello Biafra or Mike Watt, like everyone knows these people. It's almost like saints from the from biblical lore or something.
It's super true. And it's kind of like, it's funny, what sect are you? You know, like it's because like I never got into tons of like Gigi Allen stuff, but like just because of my like... After I got out of the, like, not out of it, but you kind of get, you're not listening to ska punk as much, and you're starting to listen to other stuff. It's like, I went into college into, like, hardcore. It was, like, fucking, like I said, Bad Brains, Black Flag, and I was in this band, Chodo Ghetto, and I really wanted us to sound like Bad Brains, even though we didn't. Like, I was like, this is like, I just want to sound like this, because I also was really into this band Glassjaw, which was like a hardcore band from Long Island that was on this Warped Tour that I was on in 2003.
The Post Sons of Abraham band.
Yeah, the dude Beck had that band. Yeah.
I saw Sons of Abraham.
They were like a Jewish hardcore band, right?
Yeah, they were and they stayed at my friend's house a couple times. I saw them a few times over the years. I think I still have their LP.
Yeah, and they started Glassjaw, and they really were a band that I saw on that Warped Tour. On that Warped Tour, I worked for the Plea for Peace Foundation, which was Mike Park's nonprofit. And so I met everybody there in regards to like music. And like even my friend Jeff Rosenstock, who your listeners might know or not know, really like a rad musician. We play in Bull Shannon together now, but like met there, you know. And he was in a band called the Arrogant Sons of Bitches, and he was just like, come play trumpet with us. And they were crashing the Warped Tour every day. They would literally just show up. And the security at the time was so, like, new. You know, each security at each festival is a new team. So they have no idea. You just show up and say, like, oh, hey, like, we're, you know, just checking in for the day. They have no idea. So they would play, you know. Anyways, I after that, I got really into hardcore. And I really wanted that band to sound like that. And we did. We did for a long time. And then we had a really good rhythm section. So the drummer and the bass player could do more complicated stuff. So we ended up going kind of more in the like Faith No More type world, even kind of a little bit of like Mars Volta type stuff. But yeah, anyways, that band ended in the pandemic. And now it's still going. Excuse me. I don't want to say ended. It's just kind of on pause. But Bull Shannon started, and then that's kind of what I've been cooking with recently, and that's super fun. Three basses in that band.
Three basses?
Yeah. Three bass, drums.
I was in a band with two bass players one time, but
really?
Three is definitely...
We started as two. It was just two and the drummer, yes.
Oh, that's awesome. That's very Watt.
Yeah, well, it was. It was funny, too, because we were originally going to call the band Cuz, and then the bass I play is Mike's bass, because when... the pandemic was happening, I had such like a frustrated moment where I was just like, fuck it, I'm gonna like buy the bass I want to like play, and I'm gonna learn bass. I never knew how to play.
Yeah.
And Norwood from Fishbone, he teaches lessons. Shout out to Norwood. If you want to learn a bass lesson or you're a bass player, he does really dope Zoom sessions that are really, he'll teach you an amazing way to play bass. Took those, and then we started Bull Shannon, but it was originally called Cuz. And I emailed Mike because I was so, like, nervous. I'm, like, such a rook. Like, I have your bass. And I'm like, oh, I bought your bass, da-da-da-da. And I was like, the band's called Cuz. And he was like, oh, brother Chris, like, I have the same band called Cuz. What inspired yours? I was like, well, like, Hawaiian people say Cuz all the time, but we changed it.
Yeah. Of course he has a band called that. He's got, like, a band probably.
He's got 45 bands.
Exactly.
Throw a dart and you'll hit a Mike Watt band name.
Yeah, he's definitely, like, one of those guys that, I don't know, I can't think of someone who's, like, more of a positive person to kind of run into on your journey. Like, my friend met him when he was, like, 13 doing a zine, and he was, like, writing him in the early days of email, and then one day forgot to BCC his entire email list. So my friend at 13 got, like, all the Beastie Boys email addresses, all the
Sonic Youth. He used to do those Bofus. Did you ever get those emails?
I got the Bofus ones, but this would have been, like, 19, it must be the first Bofus ones, because it's been like 94, 95. And so my friend was like, dear, like, Mike D, do you want to come and do an interview on my zine?
Oh, my God, just,
like,
dude.
It was like this amazing score for him as like a young kid.
You know who used to do that a lot? I was good buddies with Richard Lewis before he passed away. And he was like, I knew him later and like didn't know him through my father, but we connected because of my father. But he was like kind of a mentor, but he had, like, the most ridiculous relationship with, like, messaging people. And so you would get, like, at, like, 4 in the morning, like, an email, and you were, like, on the email with, like, Albert Brooks's assistant and, you know, a guitar player for Pink Floyd or, I don't know, or it was just someone who works at CNN and you, and it was just, like, a little story that was on YouTube that Lewis found about himself that he was wanting to share, or like a great tweet he had. And you, so Like, I love, like, old dude, you know, social media email interactions.
Yeah, I was trying to use the 7-Eleven app at the store the other day with my kid, and my kid had to show me how to do it, and then the person behind the counter was like, I have to help my parents with technology, too. Like,
yeah.
Man, I guess I crossed that line.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I don't have kids, but I definitely have, like, hit a wall of technology where I'm just like, I think I can skip this one. My sister was talking to me about, like, some doll, like the boo-boo doll thing or whatever.
The boo-boos.
I was like, I think I can skip this one. Because, like, I don't need to know about it because, like, it'll phase out. And I think I'll just no space, like CPU overload.
Yeah, like if you go to, like, any school that's coming back right now, the kids are, like, flooded with bootleg Labubus hanging off. My middle kid just has a severed head of one hanging off their
belt.
Hell
yeah. That's amazing.
Because they break the bootleg so easily. But I don't want to keep you all day because you're in Toronto and I figure you got some stuff to do.
Yeah, no, I'm going to do some Second City stuff tonight. If you're around, you want to come to a Second City show?
Oh, I'd love to, but it's unfortunately playoff baseball for my kids right now. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's what it definitely is like a hard thing to realize. Like, oh, I'm not going to have any nightlife anymore. And like, I think that's, once again, probably why I do the podcast, so I can kind of keep
in
touch with people. Because I also realize normal people in me don't really fit.
Oh, and, right.
Being the parents on the baseball team, I'm like, yeah, they don't get the shorthand of bringing up Mike Watt. Like,
yeah, fully. It's refreshing to have a conversation in Toronto because I don't know. I have a handful of friends here, but it's nice to meet people who are definitely part of the scene, and especially tethered back to, like, all the, you know, SoCal Jordan, Dave Markey world. Because just to say it, that punk rock world that they fostered is, like, really, really cool. Like,
yeah.
And the Bill Bartel doc, if you get a chance to watch it, does a really good job of explaining how special it was. You know,
and we're not just connected through that. We're also connected through Colin Hanks.
Was he on the show?
No, but when Breaking Bad's finale was airing, he was filming in Alberta and put out a message on Twitter that he would like someone's house to go watch because they didn't have it at the hotel.
Shut up.
And went over to my friend Josiah Hughes' house and Sarah, his partner. They played in a bunch of bands that have opened for my band on tour. And then he was on Conan relating the story. I think it was on Conan. And at the end, he's like, what was it like? He's like, they were pretty weird. And I can definitely echo Colin's thing, Colin's feelings. They're a little weird. But you might say
that.
The same thing. So you've never been to my weird ass house, too.
No. I mean, you know, dude, I dig. It's a breath of fresh air, honestly, in the sea of, like, all of the proper publicity that has to go into promoting a big movie or a proper doc release. It's nice to just talk about the stuff I like to talk about.
Well, fresh air and stale weed smoke down here.
Oh, dude, right at home, man. No, seriously, like it's all good. It's the coolest. Yeah.
Well, Chris, anytime you want to come and talk about punk or movies, you are always welcome in the basement.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.